I feel that inclusion, starting at the youngest age possible, is vital for the success of children throughout their entire school career because of the meaningful friendships and relationships they build with their peers.
Welcome to Love is a Classroom, Stories of Inclusion, a podcast that aims to serve as a bridge for a more inclusive world. I'm your host, Andrew Goff. With me today is
Christy Donathan, and I am the director of the Early Childhood Department with Mesa County Valley School District.
We started with one teacher. Episode 2 through 4 showed that the acts of one teacher have an impact that goes far beyond the classroom. In this episode, I hope you, my listener, will see that high-quality, meaningful inclusion is more than the love of one teacher, and the positive outcomes of inclusion have the potential to go just as far for children without disabilities as it does for children with disabilities. Christy Donathan's story and the responses to my question provides a glimpse behind the scenes in a school district that creates inclusive experiences like the one Archer and his family received.
Our focus is that play-based interaction with peers from our typically developing and our children with special needs, what they learn from each other, how they learn from each other, and that they are socially regulated for kindergarten teachers to then be able to really work on those academic skills. We have a very strong social-emotional curriculum that we use in preschool. And with that, we provide the teachers with so many resources to really work on that social-emotional piece. And we all know as educators, a child will not learn their ABCs. They're not going to learn their colors and their shapes and their numbers, those academic pieces, if they are socially and emotionally dysregulated.
As a teacher in play-based classrooms, there were years where I got pushback. I didn't incorporate enough direct academic instruction for four-year-olds. That's what I was told. Do you find yourself defending your department and play-based curriculums often?
There's a lot of pressure from testing in schools. When I think about kindergartners doing Dibbles testing, and these kindergarten teachers are held to how their classroom performs with reading in those Dibbles tests that are given. And so when they get these kids coming into kinder that may or may not have those academic skills, they're under pressure, because then their growth within their classroom may not be as high as they want it to be. So they come back to us saying, we need more academics. We need these skills to be a lot stronger coming into kindergarten. We also get some kickback from the K-5 system that we have so much support in preschool that they are not able to meet that same level of support in kindergarten. That's a systems problem that I can't solve by lessening my support. They have to solve it by increasing their support.
Once a month, I have meetings set up, one-on-one meetings with my supervisor. Those are held either in my office or in his office. We always try to start those meetings with what is going well, what do I need support with? These are my ideas. I'm going to need your support in bringing this forth to another meeting. From that point on, I have then been given the opportunity to speak at our leadership team meetings. And again, it's the same proposal. I've sat down with a PowerPoint, starting out with testimonials from teachers, testimonials from parents, so that they understand what inclusive preschool programs truly look like in our district and what we're offering. I have been before the board of directors. I've been in front of principals at the elementary schools. I've been in front of all of the upper admin, just giving a great overview and very personal experience of what inclusive preschool truly is and the value
of early childhood and what is the impact with graduation rates and then beyond graduation. It's a tough thing because I'm not sure how they're going to receive this information. I don't know what their understanding is of early childhood. You're meeting a pretty diverse crowd of people as far as what their understanding and their experience with early childhood is. I circled back around to our strategic plan that we have as a district, circled back around to our mission and vision in our early childhood department and the mission and vision of the school district in order to say what we're doing is supporting all of the students. I'm very hopeful when I've done those presentations that they are getting that understanding and that they're taking what I've said to heart and wanting to provide the support that we need to have a successful program. I've walked away sometimes feeling disheartened, not knowing that I've made my point or gotten that understanding across.
I'm curious to hear your perspective on one of my greatest challenges with principals and administrators. Principals and district administrators often put implicit pressure, as much as the teachers, on me to place children in segregated settings, such as an autism classroom. How do you support kindergarten transitions?
Our district is large. We're in 21 different elementary schools and with 31 classrooms. So in order to reach out to all of those principals, trying to find a time to really share this, it's tough. Where I'd like to see is a better process, and we're working on it this year, of our transition from preschool into kindergarten. We've done bits and pieces of that transition throughout the years. I'm trying to streamline that to where it really looks the same at all of our schools. And that is having the kindergarten teachers visit a preschool classroom, just as a teacher, just to sit in and be an observer. Have the preschool children be allowed to go into the kindergarten classroom. And also this year, we want to connect them with the specials teachers. So PE, music, library, all of those areas as well. And to be able to either given time at staff meetings in the elementary school to present bits and pieces of our curriculum and our program. And if that's beyond my capacity at 21 schools, is we've got a video library. And so I'm reaching out to principals, gosh, at your staff meeting, even if every staff meeting you can show a 5-minute little snippet of a practice that we do in preschool, and those teachers can see what truly is happening within our classrooms. So I'm hoping to be able to bridge that gap and have a little bit better vertical alignment into the elementary school.
I have to imagine that advocating for your department can take an emotional toll on you. How do you get back up when you've been kicked down?
Where I get kind of my lifting me back up sometimes when I am somewhat feeling let down by the support that we need or that I'm hoping for, is that I do have the support from the preschool staff, from those 100 staff members, truly believe that every one of us is advocating for the importance of inclusion, for the importance of early childhood, and really advocating for what we do and that we are doing the right things. And so we are sticking to what we believe it is the right way and advocating for that understanding and acceptance into the K-5 system. Several years ago, we were partnering with Colorado Department of Education with CDE. They actually brought people and did specific training for a limited number of our staff members on effective teaming, and it lasted an entire year. When we started working with CDE, we really brought in people from every aspect. We had early childhood special educators, we had the admin, we had lead preschool teachers, we had assistants, we also had our additional support paras involved, we had somebody from speech language pathologist on that team, and really just a diverse group. in order to really hear from everybody's different perspectives. So then what we did from that is we brought them back the following year and had them present to all staff. And we had a leadership team that they came to once a month and worked with us. And then we took that information then to all staff. And we have continued that. That was supposed to be a one-year project. We brought it out and spread it out into a three-year project. We have included that effective teaming into a lot of our professional development. The SMART goals that I have teachers make, they make an individual goal and they also make an effective teaming goal. It's a SMART goal. So it's specific, it's measurable, it's attainable, it's realistic, and it's timely. That's done at the beginning of every school year as a team, that collaboration of giving them some guidelines of these are the things to think about as you're creating the goal, is how is it going to really support all the children in the classroom and how it's inclusive, how it's developmentally appropriate, what you're doing, really treating that as a live document that is very fluid depending on who their team is, who their students are, what their needs are. When we finished up, we morphed that into an instructional focus team. And so now we have the two combined, instructional focus team and effective teaming together.
In episode one, Rochelle talked about the importance of the teaming and how it played such an important role on Archer and his family. How do you keep the teams together and on the same page after the trainers are gone or even as staff changes over the years?
We spent a lot of time developing our norms, and all of the staff have been a part of that development. We've gone back through and we've kind of revised those as we've had so much staff turnover so that everyone feels they're a part. The whole early childhood mission and vision. So we use breakout sessions to really identify with the school district's mission and vision, the early childhood special education mission and vision, our mission and vision, and really see how those are all connected. And we really dug into then how does that translate into our classrooms. And that's been, I think that that's gone over well. And I think that the teachers are very well aware of what those are and how we move forward with those. So because we've worked so hard to provide that training for effective teaming, when these teams, such as Rochelle and the rest of that staff gets together, their meetings are much more focused. And so their time is spent really focusing on the students and the families, which then, carries into at the beginning of the year into that home visit where you really build that connection.
That's amazing. How does it translate into what teachers report and what you see when you go and visit the inclusive classrooms? Do you see outcomes for children that reflect all the work that's being done?
Being in an inclusive program, children have the opportunity for social interactions and strong relationships with their typically developing peers. And then if we look at the impact that the typically developing peers have, that same thing, they're doing better academically, socially, emotionally, and behaviorally. They form meaningful relationships. They learn to appreciate and accept individual differences. So, when I'm in classrooms, I'll hear those typically developing students use the term, he's growing his brain, or she's growing her brain. We hear a lot, well, he just learns differently. And so just being able to really help those children understand that there's not a barrier. There's not, everyone in that classroom is special and unique, regardless of what their, disability is. We're looking at their abilities.
What about the child who throws the chair across the classroom, the child who has emotional explosions on a regular basis? I'm sure you have teachers who say, yeah, inclusion is great, but...
So we do a lot of training on the pyramid model, to where we really build the bottom of the pyramid as the foundation. That is what supports 100% of our children. And if that is strong, using the supports and the resources that we have, then as you go up the pyramid, you're looking at fewer and fewer kids. So when you're talking about that child that's blowing out, he is the top of the pyramid. And so we are looking at what support do we need in that classroom for that child or those, you know, one or two children. It's, you know, it is typically 1 or 2% of our kids that are at the top of the pyramid. And we really work hard with all of our student services, those special service providers, to provide the support for those individual children. Again, our focus is to really, at an all-staff training, is to work on teaching the strategies and really putting in place what's going to be the base of that pyramid and really solidifying those things so that is the strongest it can be. And I can go into a classroom, and every one of our classrooms has that child that you just described. Some of them, you're going to really see that a lot more, and some of them you're not. And, you know, I'll do videotapes of classrooms that, wow, look at how great these things are. And the teachers will say, but they don't have the student like I have. And my response is, yes, they do. And because the bottom of that pyramid is so strong, that that's such a minimal piece at the top of the pyramid. And so they do, they look at it and say, yeah, but that's not my class. It is every one of our 21 classrooms.
I, too, am a strong believer in the pyramid model. I'll share a few resources and an overview of the pyramid model in the show notes for the listeners.
I came in as the assistant director, and so really was a year of learning. And what I learned that first year was really the importance of building relationships with the teachers. So I was brought in, and I was their evaluator. And they didn't know who I was. They didn't know what experience I had. Somebody completely strange coming in and saying, you know, they'd been in Mesa County for 15 years teaching preschool. And here's this newcomer coming in to say, well, this is what you need to change, or this is what you need to do differently. So I used that first year as a means for me to build a community and to build those trusting relationships. When I started, the supervisor, the director that I worked under, really, I kept bringing things to her and saying, what if? And she would kind of just shoot me down a little bit. When she retired and I stepped into the director's role, I thought, okay, now's my opportunity. I'm going to do all of those what ifs. That's when I started really reaching out to the upper administration and really asking and advocating for things that I felt needed to be done. It's been really tough trying to decide what do I take forward with them and what do I just take what I learned from my director.
What has been the most challenging thing for you to learn to navigate in your role as the director? Something perhaps that you hadn't considered as the assistant?
I think that I've had to learn Mesa County's program, their procedures, and, you know, what it looks like in the elementary schools, because I haven't worked in the elementary schools here. So that's been kind of a learning curve for me, so that I want the elementary schools to understand early childhood. I've had to learn, you know, what their roles are and what they're looking at in the elementary schools and what programs they have.
What recommendations do you have for administrators who want to create more inclusive early childhood classrooms like Rochelle's, or even districts that are more inclusive?
I looked back at a book written by Julie Costin from Inclusive Schooling, and the book is called I Think There's Been a Mistake, and it really is talking about forming lines and forming circles and becoming a circle maker. And I think sharing that to other administrators, some of the questions, and I'm going to read these, it comes from what they call the inclusion quotient. Do you have clearly written public inclusive plan for your school? Do your school leaders and teachers believe that all students should have access to inclusive education? Is disability seen as a difference, not a deficit? Do all students have access to their home school, the school they would attend if they don't have a disability? And I feel like if administration across our district, across the state, could go in and answer those questions, that it really brings out where they need to move forward to creating an inclusive program.
Rochelle mentioned inclusive schooling too. I'll share a link to their resources in the show notes, including the book and their website. Christy, Donathan, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk to me about all the amazing work you're doing in District 51.
Oh, you're welcome.
I went into my first series of Love is a Classroom, Stories of Inclusion, wondering, how do I do this? How do I allow others' stories to paint a picture of the power of inclusion through a podcast? It started with a teacher, Rochelle, and her story about the inclusion of a boy with cerebral palsy in her ECE classroom. I interviewed her and began looking for my next guest, other teachers. But the more I thought about her interview, the more I realized that limiting the podcast to the stories and experiences of teachers does not paint a picture of high-quality, meaningful inclusion because it's not the acts of one individual teacher. It's a system. When Zach and Anita, Archer's parents, and Archer and his sisters, Aubrey and Aaliyah, said they wanted to contribute, I thought, that's perfect. Listeners will be able to hear about the impact of Rochelle's work. But even after talking with the Hamilton family, the series felt incomplete because all parents are different. Parents fuel the system, but they aren't the engineers or mechanics of the system that make inclusion possible. I consulted with Rochelle and she said, Andrew, talk to Christy Donathan. She's the director of the early childhood department in D51. Without her leadership, Rochelle said, the inclusion of children with disabilities would be much more difficult. Inclusion requires a community grounded in love. It is a system. I hope to continue to illuminate this in future series. Thank you for listening to Love is a Classroom, Stories of Inclusion. Please subscribe to the podcast, post a review, and share our episodes. You can follow us at Love is a Classroom on Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube. If you're a teacher, parent, or advocate who would like to share your story, please go to loveisaclassroom.com, click on contact, and share a brief summary of your experience. Until next time, choose love, choose inclusion.